Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Histories of the Unexpected, the show where we demonstrate that everything, simply everything, has its own history. Like the bed, hair or beards, plague, ague or vague. Sam, I've always been fascinated in the history of vagueness. I think we should definitely do the history of vagueness. Or fun, bun and homespun. In this period of lockdown, we're recording this at the height of the coronavirus, everything is being homespun. People are making things, don't you find?
Yes, absolutely. I want to do the history of vagueness as well. I think that's a really, really good idea.
Most history should be vague, I feel. We will, however, be following the links in our minds as we come across them, as always, explaining how those histories link together in unexpected ways. Who knew, for example, who knew, Sam, that the history of humour, as I feel it's a time for humour, is all about the release of social tension, political lampooning, gender politics, mothers-in-law, and of course, springtime frivolity. With April Fool's Day just around the corner, we should definitely do something on tricks. Or that the history of chairs is all about monarchy, the death penalty, punishment, witches, and of course, how could we forget, the invention of comfort.
Oh, that's very good. Very good, James. Well, I've been thinking about the history of clouds as well. I went for an early morning dog walk this morning. Did you know the history of clouds is all about navigation and weather forecasting, the devil, urine, nuclear war, invisible gases and cholera?
I imagine it is. Do you know, I've been doing a lot of homeschooling and I learned all about clouds the other day. I helped my 8-year-old daughter create a cloud wheel. So I'm all up for a podcast on clouds.
Well, I think we should do that too. Listen, the man sitting opposite me, let's just say that if you were history, he would get you into a lava. It is Professor Extraordinaire, James Daybell.
Hello, Sam. That is so funny. And the man sitting opposite me is the distant friend across town, the truly wonderful historical adventurer, Dr. Sam Willis. I miss you, Sam.
I miss you, James. I miss you, James. I'm hoping...
So I've been recording a little series of homeschooling podcasts, and you know what? It doesn't feel the same without you. I do genuinely miss you. and we should be whizzing all over the country now, doing all sorts of things, events, shows, going to schools. But instead, we're locked inside. And so... We're bringing ourselves to you via the wonders of the podcast and internet.
We are, and to see if it all works. And we decided to do a few linked to coronavirus. So we've done, we did one on contagion in a fever itself of creativity in the car, which I was very pleased with. We're now going to be doing soap today. And I think we've got the history of loneliness coming up.
I've just been sent a very interesting new book on loneliness, which I'm going to read for that by a woman called Faye Bound, who's written on all sorts of things, but she's just published a new book on loneliness. So we will talk about that.
Absolutely. But today we're going to be doing the history of soap, which I feel like I've got a new relationship with the history of soap. But actually, for those of you interested in what we're talking about, a long time ago, James and I did an episode on the history of hands. So if you're finding yourself with a new relationship with your hands, do go back to our archive of podcasts and check out the one on the history of hands, because it's absolutely fascinating. But I'm finding, particularly while we're talking about soap and hands, that I'm coming across a new relationship with my hands. I'm becoming quite paranoid about my hands, and my hands are getting quite sore as well from all of the washing. And also the not touching things. My elbows have become sore from touching everything with my elbow.
You need to rethink in a different way. I mean, I wonder whether before we start kicking off with soap, whether it's just worth pondering about the situation that we're in. Because I think the situation that we're in lockdown, a global pandemic, is something that these have happened in the past, but it is something that is really epoch changing for us potentially. And there are two really interesting things. One is, how will historians in the future look back and study this period? And what can we do as historians to make sure that we record as much of what is going on today? You know, our everyday reactions of school being shut, being locked in the house, all the sort of community outreach that we're seeing all over the place. But also thinking about it in a sort of historical continuum, how is this going to change the way in which the world operates in the future in all sorts of ways? I mean, you just have a look at the kind of financial packages that governments around the world are introducing in order to shore up the economy, the global economy, and what kind of impact is that going to have? You know, in terms of social relationships, how is that going to suddenly be impacted? The way in which we're now all interacting online, not that we weren't before, but it sort of fast-tracked all sorts of things that I think as a historian, you know, it's time to ponder.
No, I completely agree. And all of these interesting themes that are coming up at the moment, I think will help us do that. You know, being able to think about loneliness or whatever it might be, or soap or hands or contagion in all of these different ways. And going through this experience will also help us, you know, understand what on earth is going on. So when it comes to soap, there are so many different ways you can actually think about soap, aren't there? And let's do our sort of initial kind of brainstorm of the ways you can think about soap.
Think about the traditional history of soap, and you can think about the invention and use of soap. And soap has a history that you can trace back, as always, to ancient times. I think they discovered soap in Pompeii. Soap is used throughout the medieval period. There's a shift, I think, in the 19th century with the sort of discovery of germs and various sort of scientists discovering the sort of history of germs, that germs actually spread disease. People like Louis Pasteur and his discovery of microbes, the surgeon Joseph Lister, and the development of hygiene policies, Robert Koch, and his sort of work on germs, each disease being traced back to individual germs. And then there is the way in which there's the way in which hands are vectors of spreading germs and disease. So you can think about soap in that sort of sense. You can also think about the uses of soap, not just for medicine, but also in terms of not just hygiene, but also in terms of laundry, disinfecting. You can think about it in terms of advertising, marketing. So you can see it in all those kinds of ways. You can also think about the kinds of packaging and advertising for it. One of the things I want to talk about is soap boxes later on, which gets us out of soap. But these are the crates that would have packaged soap, turned upside down, were a sort of platform for people to talk about freedom of speech and political ideas and social revolution. Soft soaping is all about the history of flattery. You're rolling your eyes, Willis.
No, I was just wondering when you were going to stop. It's very good. There is a great deal of things you can do. I was thinking about, you know, the making is interesting, and then the inventing of it, who invented it where and how that spread around the world. I think it's fascinating, the idea of things developing at the same time in the same place or not. Innovations, patents, or the 19th century patents for soap would be fascinating. It's one of my favourite things, to go to the British Library and to explore the patents when they're registered. Different types of soap. I can see that aromatic soap, so smells, come in primarily from the Italians. So we would have been using soap which cleaned us, but which absolutely reeked because it was primarily made out of animal fats. So you've got this a sort of changing idea of of, you know, what is acceptable and things that can make you smell nice linked with invention as well, I think is fascinating.
Early monopoly on soap.
The monopoly on soap connects us to Charles I's personal rule. So that period when he before the English Civil War, when he dispensed with Parliament, he raised his taxes in various sort of crafty ways, including the granting of monopolies to all sorts of trades. And one of the things he granted a monopoly for is soap.
There's the history of monopolies and tax and all the economics involved in it as well. So tax was also one of, soap was also one of these objects which was taxed along with bricks and windows and tobacco and sugar and tea. So there's also a history of the smuggling of soap, which I think is fascinating. We also did a little podcast on the history of bubbles. So you can think about people using soap for things not necessarily for cleaning. Lubrication is one, but play is another. So there'll be a lot of people at home with kids. Just make some bubble blowers. Do some bubble blowing. It's so simple. It's so fun. And it's a very, very ancient way of passing the time as well. And listen to our podcast on bubbles.
My daughters have been washing their dolls in the bath with lots and lots of soapy water. we've been doing all sorts of inventive things during this period of homeschooling. Is it worth talking about the science of soap as well?
Absolutely, yeah.
So the science, I was very interested in why we are all washing our hands so much and the sort of the science behind that. And this is basically because the soap does kill the virus. So there was an article in The Guardian that I read called The Science of Soap. Here's How It Kills the Coronavirus by Paul Thordarson. And it says here, so why does soap work so well on the SARS-CoV-2, the coronavirus, and indeed most viruses? And the article goes on, the short story, because the virus is a self-assembled nanoparticle in which the weakest link is the lipid or fatty bilayer. So this is the sort of layer that coats it. Soap dissolves the fat membrane and the virus falls apart like a house of cards and dies. Or rather, we should say it becomes inactive as viruses aren't really alive. Isn't that brilliant? So just simply washing your hands very vigorously for about 20 seconds is very effective at getting rid of it. Isn't that good? And you should apparently sing two sort of happy birthdays to yourself. But I was thinking, what other kinds of songs could you sing during this period? I think I heard this on the news quiz, and they suggested, this brought me back to my childhood, the Police song "Don't Stand So Close to Me." A couple of lines of that would be quite good at the moment.
That's excellent. So where should we start then? What do you want to do?
Well, one of the things I was interested in is the history of soap against disease. So I talked earlier on about the way in which doctors and scientists discovered germs during the 19th century. We then have the outbreak of Spanish flu in 1918, which sort of goes around the globe, kills a ton of people. And what's fascinating is the response of the soap industry to that. And we've got a series of adverts that come out after the influenza of that period that are recommending themselves as a way of getting rid of influenza. There's an advert for Lifebuoy soap, and it describes itself, the influenza scourge. The father who links up the Lifebuoy soap links up his whole family with smiling health. There's nothing like Lifebuoy for introducing a wholesome cleanliness everywhere and destroying the germs of disease and sickness. And you've got a picture here of a guy in a sou'wester with a sort of waterproof hat on, holding a Lifebuoy, saves life. So it's soap is recommended. There's an article from the Ministry of Health in support of Boots the Chemist for the importance of health. Sunlight Soap, there's another advert. A big tonic supply and demand. The makers of Sunlight Soap have laboured unceasingly to procure an ever-increasing supply of the purest materials in order to meet the demands for this efficient friend of the housewife. So there are all sorts of things. Jay's Fluid, it guards against influenza, scarlet fever, smallpox, measles and all infectious diseases for the daily use of Jay's Fluid. The ideal disinfectant. Safe, efficient, economical. Use it in your bath. Spray the atmosphere of the home, factory, office, cinema. Disinfect all lavatories, sinks and drains. Invaluable for use in schools. All chemists sell Jay's Fluid, the best disinfectant. And you could go on. So it's not just now that we are thinking about soap as a product to combat viruses. This is something that happened in the early 20th century too, after the pandemic of Spanish flu.
I've been thinking about eating soap.
Oh! Now that is unexpected. Eating soap? Yes. Wash your mouth out with soap. It's all about swearing.
There we go. You know what I'm talking about. However, there are various aspects to it. There's the first one I came across that made me think about this actually was a cartoon, like a Giles cartoon or something from the 20s maybe. Newspaper cartoon with a parrot sitting on a perch surrounded in bubbles. And the strap line was like, oh, I made him wash his mouth out with soap. So you've got the idea of this parrot being really rude and someone force feeding this parrot soap, who was then spouting bubbles rather than soap. But there is a whole fascinating history about of people eating soap or being made to eat soap. It's something that I've come across as well in my career as a naval historian. And we recently published something on the Navy Record Society online magazine, which is brilliant. If any of you have not come across it yet, please go to navyrecords.org.uk. And this is the diary of a chap called Victor Hutley, who was sailing on HMS Repulse in 1925 and going on a world tour in this period after the First World War, before the outbreak of the Second World War. It's absolutely fascinating for all sorts of things. But most interestingly is that they're all on board ship when they cross the equator. And there is a long established tradition of hazing, I think it might be described as now. So people kind of initiating those who have not been initiated. And on a ship, it took a very strange appearance, and it took a very strange form. I've got a bit of an extract from his diary, which I'm going to read you here. Everyone is trembling with excitement at the prospect of the process of initiation, which is the lot of those who have not crossed the line before. A great canvas bath has been rigged forward beneath the turrets and staging erected round it so that the old sea dogs can watch the novices being dipped. Neptune put in an appearance at 9:30 this morning and was accompanied by guards of police dressed in bright red jerseys, sea boots and cocked hats with skull and crossbones on the side, followed by the bears pulling the chariot containing Neptune and Amphitrite. I don't know how to say that. Amphitrite. Following in procession with a clerk, doctor, barber, lather friends, mermaids and a heterogeneous collection of other oddments. The greetings of the previous night were repeated, and after the procession had taken position on the staging, greetings were given to the prince, who was standing with Sir Lionel Halsey and other senior officers on another part of the scaffold. He mentions the prince. This is actually the actual prince, the Prince of Wales, who is joining them. Anyway, This is the key bit, James. The clerk who was the first man you met and then the doctor who gave you a soap pill of enormous dimensions, seating yourself on the tipping stool by the edge of the bath, you then had to submit to a process of lathering with an enormous paintbrush and a shave with an enormous razor. When quite suddenly the seat gave way and you did a beautiful back somersault into the water, your eyes, your ears and your mouth full of beastly soap. So, that is one of so many wonderful examples of people being made to eat soap in the Royal Navy or on merchant ships as well, crossing the equator. But what I think is fascinating about this is two things. The first is that there's a material culture of evidence of this, because the people who survived were often either tattooed, so it's a material culture on people's skin, or they were given an actual certificate. And at the collections of the National Maritime Museum in Greenwich, there are lots of fabulously homespun, homemade, unique certificates handed out to people to say that they'd gone through this process. They'd been washed clean, essentially, of their previous selves. So you've got this idea of the soap changing people, being an agent of change. And the soap and the shaving is so crucial in this ritual. So you'll turn from a novice of the sea into an experienced mariner, someone who can handle the hard work, someone who's done the time at sea, a bit like being in a prison. But the idea behind it is that the soap can cleanse, that the soap can make people change. And that is just one aspect of a history which can go on and on and on. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that in a few more minutes.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually quite dangerous to eat soap, isn't it?
Yes, yes.
I'm reading here that it causes even ordinary bars of soap and liquid hand soaps can be in really bad for you. Vomiting, diarrhea, irritate the lining of your mouth, your digestive tract. It's terrible. I mean, I think also, isn't there a history of giving, you know, the idea wash your mouth out with soap and water is related to kids who are basically, you know, foul-mouthed.
Yes, and there's a real and fascinating history of that. It was particularly prevalent in the UK and in the US. But just before we move on to that, I want to talk about this idea because of hazing, of basically being punished or being beaten up or you know, being bullied using soap. And I found a copy of an amazing book in the online library of the University of California. And this is brilliant. I really, really enjoyed reading this. So here we are, February the 9th, 1901. And it's published by the US Congress, and it's entitled An Investigation of Hazing of the United States Military Academy. So there is there's like a tribunal, okay? And some leading military figures have been sent to West Point, which is where all the officers are trained for the US Armed Forces. And there have obviously been complaints of hazing. And what happens is that they get a load of recruits in and ask them what's happened to them. And they also get in a load of doctors and ask them about what they think the impact of all of this is. And there's the transcriptions are fabulous. So bear with me when I just find these.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door.
Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Here we go. What I think is interesting is actually the variety of different names of things that these people suffered, as well, of which eating soap was just one. Okay, here we go. I want to make an inquiry with reference to the resolution adopted by the class. Under the term hazing, let me ask you if these may be included. Bracing. No. You do not call that hazing? No, sir, I do not. What about wooden willies? Yes, sir, that definitely is hazing.
What is wooden willies?
I haven't found out. I want to know.
Right.
Football. Yes, sir. Eagling. Yes, sir. Hanging on a stretcher. Yes, sir. Box holding. By that, do you mean holding out the cleaning box? Yes, that is definitely hazing. Chinning? No, sir. Putting hot tallow or grease on the feet? Definitely yes. And then it keeps on going. Under what heading does dropping hot tallow on the feet come? I don't know what heading that would come under. I suppose that would come under hazing more than anything else. Sitting on a bayonet? Yes, sir. Hazing. Sweating? Hazing. Chew-chewing? Hazing. Chewing on rope ends? That would definitely be hazing if it were done, but I have not heard of it being done for 2 years. Anyway, we come to the meat of it, James. Eating soap. I don't know whether I would consider that hazing or not, but it definitely happens. Eating quinine. Yes, sir, that would definitely come under hazing. So you don't think there should be a difference between eating soap and eating quinine? No, sir. I mean, yes, sir, both of them should come under it. So this goes on for pages and pages, but they're trying to get a grip, firstly, on what is happening in the dormitories of this US academy, and then they're trying to stop it. It's a fascinating book, and I would urge you all to see if you can track it down.
And often these kind of rituals, it's not just within the armed forces, the Navy, but it's also within certain schools and universities or colleges, and they're part of a sort of violent form of initiation, and they lead to all sorts of things. And the authorities, the institutions themselves, disapprove of them, and in fact they're often illegal, and so these activities are going on without the permission of the authorities. So they're going on under the radar. In America, in American universities, it's something that you find in particularly male fraternities, but also in sororities, where people have to perform all sorts of, humiliating initiation rites, like wandering around the town half naked and cleaning up all sorts of, mess and vomit. Having taught in the US for 3 years, about 15 years ago, you would hear about all of these activities, including bizarre things like stealing people's shoes and tying the laces together and then throwing them over telegraph wires. I remember in the town where I lived, just driving down one of the main streets that was called Fraternity Row and looking up and just wondering why there were a dozen pairs of trainers with their laces tied over these telegraph wires. And I think it's all part of this sort of hazing sort of initiation ceremony.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the final bit here is when they get a doctor in to... So obviously some recruits become extremely unwell and injured through his hazing. Yeah. When your brother went to see Dr. Groom to be treated for hemorrhoids, did it occur to you at the time that it was on account of the hazing that he was ill? Answer, yes. And then when we went to see the doctor about his indigestion, do you think it was due to the hazing at West Point? I thought it was from what they made him do, eating soap and quinine pills and such things. And then when he was finally ill with pneumonia, you thought that was to do with hazing. He says, yes. That was an interesting link with pneumonia. Anyway, they then interview the doctor and they ask about whether eating soup will cause soap would cause indigestion and blah, blah. And he talks about the impact of inflaming the stomach on soap. So be careful with what you do with your soap, ladies and gentlemen. Please make sure you don't eat it. But the washing of mouth out with soap itself is amazing. A quote here from the Good Housekeeping Guide in 1889. A friend of mine was horrified one day by hearing her little boy make use of a very bad word. Turning to the maid, she said, Jane, you may take Master Dick upstairs and wash his mouth out with soap and water. It is too soiled for him to sit at the table with us.
Oh, that's extraordinary. What I find, I remember as a kid, when I was a very good boy, not really, but, you know, I remember sort of the phrase, wash your mouth out with soap and water, not necessarily used to me. I never had my mouth washed out with soap and water. My parents were wonderful, patient individuals. But it struck me, just doing a little bit of reading about this, how prevalent this seems to have been. And there's all sorts of evidence, particularly in the US, where parents seem to have used this as a form of punishment. And you have it in orphan asylums, within the criminal justice system. There's a study at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts, which was carried out in 2006, where somebody teaching there interviewed all their colleagues about their upbringing, and apparently in about 20% of the cases, people remembered having soap put in their mouths after they said something that their parents had disagreed with, or something that was sort of a profanity. I mean, you're talking about one-fifth. I mean, I thought it was almost a sort of an urban myth, this sort of wash your mouth out with soap and water, something in comic books, like the Dandy or the Beano or, you know, something like that.
Yeah.
But it actually went on.
It did actually go on.
I love this. So have you got any more on eating soap?
Well, yes, a bit, because one of the other things that was used in the manufacturing of soaps is castor oil, which is also used as an industrial lubricant, among anything else. And that was forced down people's throats as a punishment as well, yes. Particularly, most famously, by the Italians. So if you look at fascist Italy under Mussolini... The black shirts there are using this soap-like substance or this ingredient in soap to force feed people castor oil to make them unwell. It's a very violent form of torture, essentially.
Goodness me. Well, I want to move on and talk about soap boxes. So soap boxes would be originally the sort of packing crates that would have transported soap and other dry goods from where they were made to where they were going to be sold. And the soap box was originally used as a platform for public speaking. So what somebody would do is they would put the soap box down, stand up on it so that they would be raised up above the crowd, and then they would talk about all sorts of things to do with politics. This comes around during the 19th century, and there are various sort of famous soapbox orators from this period. This is also a period when we have the rise of Speaker's Corner in a particular part of Hyde Park in London, where since 1872, people would get together to discuss religion, politics and various other things. It's still thriving today, and you see it as a site during the demonstrations against the Iraq War, for example, you know, back in the early 2000s, it was a place where people would congregate. And that has a very interesting history. It also connects us to politics, because I don't know whether you remember back to the 1992 general election, This was a time when the Conservative Party were in the doldrums. Neil Kinnock's Labour Party were looking like they were going to win. And the Tory leader at the time was John Major. And one of the things that he did was he did his soapbox campaign. And so rather than the very slick Labour Party campaign, what he did was he basically went to the streets. And a lot of the campaign was him turning up in places, mixing with the ordinary people, the everyday people, going out and giving these impromptu, well, they were probably rehearsed speeches, but certainly going out, sitting, standing there and talking to the crowds. And it was actually a very effective, very, very effective campaign. And they won in excess of 14 million votes, which is one of the highest majorities that any sort of political party had at the time in a British general election. But what's fascinating also is the development of public speech and Speaker's Corner as a site for public speeches and debates from the sort of mid-1800s. And this was an area on the northeast edge of Hyde Park. It's quite near Oxford Street. Do you know where Oxford Street and Marble Arch is? It's just there. And you can go along on a Sunday and you'll see all sorts of people there literally standing on soapboxes talking about various things that they have in mind. It's somewhere where Karl Marx went to, George Orwell, Vladimir Lenin. And in 1872, an Act of Parliament set this area aside as a place for public speaking. This was a site where there had been various meetings there that were previously had been seen as illegal or some sort of form of riot. So, for example, in 1866, there was a meeting of the Reform League. These were the people who demanded an extension of the franchise. In other words, they demanded that more people should be given the vote. This meeting was suppressed by government. There was also in response to this, the people found that the park was locked and they couldn't get into it in order to speak. And so demonstrators basically tore up all the railings so that they could go in. And the next year, in 1867, a crowd of 150,000 marched on Hyde Park. And the police and troops didn't intervene during this period. And after that, in 1872, we have the Parks Regulation Act. And this gave people the right to meet and speak freely in Hyde Park. And you can, you know, as I said, you can go there today. And it is almost a sort of place for, you know, total and utter freedom of speech. Although I imagine nowadays, with the rise of hate speech and the rise of, terrorism, that it is policed a little more and people aren't allowed to go there and spread sort of hateful messages. But nonetheless, this is the way that soap boxes, the technology for carrying soap, can connect us to politics and freedom of speech and popular politics and the mass and the mob and crowds and all sorts of ideas.
Right. So you need to think about this practically, right? You need a box to stand on. To stand up, right? So there are a lot of different types of boxes. It's actually really important. So why soap? Okay, and the answer, I've just realised, or I think this is true, I don't know about this at all, but soap's a luxury item, okay? It's taxed. So until, you know, the sort of the 18th century, it was very difficult for people to actually get decent soap. So the only people who got soap were the wealthy. And the kind of the minorities in society. There's a lovely quote from Samuel Pepys's diary, and he's using demonstrating that soap is a luxury gift for a lady of quality. In the morning, I fell to my lute till 9 o'clock, then to my lord's lodging, and set out a barrel of soap to be carried to Mrs. Anne, who was Lady Anne Montague. But the point is, soap is something that is intricately and intimately associated with the upper classes, with the people with money, which means the people who have a voice, the people who have a vote. And what's happening here is they are literally turning it upside down and standing on top of it.
Very clever. Very clever. It's the world turned upside down in revolutionary terms by standing on a soapbox. Oh, that I love it.
Exactly.
Did you make that up?
Eh?
Did you make that up?
Yeah, literally just struck me. No, I think they're making themselves, they're giving themselves a voice, and they're doing it in a really symbolic, interesting way.
Very good.
Yeah, I deserve some kind of award for being a historian for that.
You did, definitely. The Daybell Soap Historian Award.
That's very good. Just thinking about that briefly, you could just mention the fact that it was taxed, and it was taxed until 1835. It was taxed for over a century from 1712. There are accounts of people smuggling soap and smuggling the other things you need for soap. So you need salt as well, particularly around the Welsh coasts, which I think is really, really interesting. And this idea also, one of the ways that you made soap was with tallow, but the other, which comes from animal fats, but the other use for tallow is light. So if you were poor and you were living on the coast and you managed to come across or to get hold of some kind of cargo of tallow, you've got the sense of coastal communities being flooded with luxury goods that no one knew what to do with. But the point is, you had to make a decision between whether you're going to use that tallow for light or cleanliness. And I think that's fascinating. And I wonder how many other items there are out there which posed people with a fundamental dilemma about things that would improve their lives. And they have to decide which way to go. So would you go light or would you go cleanliness?
I would probably do both. So I wouldn't want a little bit of both. I wouldn't want to smell, and nor would I not want to be able to read of an evening. They're a very practical man.
Yeah.
Well, who knew that soap was so interesting?
Well, and also there's the whole history of coconuts, which I've discovered is completely amazing. So the other people using coconut oils to make soap as well. And the history of coconut. So how do you get coconut oils and where have the coconuts come from? And which is opens up an amazing story of global trade. And some people have recently done an amazing study on the DNA of coconuts. And they've discovered that actually they thought it was going to be a mishmash with coconuts coming from all over the world. And it's not. And they can prove that actually there were two very succinct focused areas of coconut production in different parts of the world, in East and in West. And it means now, well, just also, you know, think about how useful coconuts are. I'm not just saying that coconuts are used for soap, but they're actually amazing for all sorts of things. You can drink them, you can eat them, you can burn them. They're an amazing, they're like a Swiss army knife of vegetables. So anyway, we now know that we can trace the history of humans moving around the world by looking at their impact on the DNA of coconuts. Which I think is wonderful, and I love that. And just one use of it was coming to soaps. Did you know the Mutiny on the Bounty was begun by people raiding a locker in which they were locked up coconuts?
I did not, no.
Yeah, because they're so yummy to eat and drink. And they're healthy. And they're sterile as well. Completely sterile, coconut water. Yeah, you can actually use it as a... If you need a saline drip and you can't get any, you can use coconut water.
Gosh, we should be eating coconuts today. I feel they would be virus free.
yeah, they would. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for listening to our unexpected history of coconuts. I very much enjoyed that. Oh, sorry, it was our unexpected history of soap.
Yes. thank you for listening to that. Yes.
Do follow me on Twitter. I'm at Dr. Sam Willis.
And you can follow me at James Daybell. And you can follow the podcast Twitter feed on at Unexpected Pod. We were supposed to be on tour, but unfortunately, our touring has all had to be rearranged for the autumn. And we're working very hard on that. But you can still be in touch with us. You can listen to the podcast. You can get in touch with us via our website, historiesoftheunexpected.com. And you can also support us on our Patreon account to help us keep this going during this time of global crisis.
And in the meantime, do please enjoy the podcast. Stay safe, everyone, and keep in touch. Send us some tweets, hit us up on Instagram, whatever. Get in touch. Give us some ideas. All right, bye.
Bye, guys. Thanks for listening.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.